We're two-thirds through.
Oh, yeah, we're doing great. So we did. This week is March 24th, 2014. Last week we did 400, but I just put it on the top since you didn't get a sheet last week, right? So this week we're doing the...
It's recording, but it's
sheet. Yeah, I'm recording. Yeah, the Ola Tamid and the Musaf of Shabbos and the Rosh Chodesh. Make sure my ring is off. Did we start the Ola Tamid last week?
Hold on. I don't think so, because I don't have... No, I don't
think
so.
Okay, good. Excellent. Okay, so we're doing 401 to 402 this week, Be'ezrat Hashem. So these are three different korbanot. The Ola Tamid, the regular everyday offering, the Shabbos Musaf, and the Musaf of Rosh Chodesh, all different things. And then we'll see if we'll get to some mystical stuff. Because there is.
We're not going to do 400?
We did 400 last week.
That's the one we did. That's the one we did last week.
We did that last week. I just put it on the paper.
Yeah.
We missed you. Yeah.
We did miss you.
We missed you, Miriam.
I'm trying, guys. There's only so much room in the tank for gas. I just ran out of everything.
This is where you go to get refilled.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's just keep in mind two important parshiot that we have. So Emor and Pinchas. Emor is where we hear about all the holidays. Pinchas is where we hear about the korbanot for each holiday. So that's just part of your yidiot, klaliot that you should have, your general knowledge that should be in your head. So if somebody talks about Pinchas, right away you should be thinking korbanot of yantifs. Somebody says Emor, right away you should be thinking that's where all the holidays are listed. So here we are in Pinchas, but there's another important thing going on in Pinchas. Not that I know the whole story. I wish I knew Torah better, but as you know, I'm still learning. But one of the things that's happening in Parshat Pinchas is a transition in the way Hashem behaves with us and the way we behave towards Hashem. And the reason for that transition is that Moshe knows he's going to die soon, and there's going to have to be a transition in leadership. So in this parsha, he asks Hashem to please appoint the leader coming up. And Hashem responds with this Korban Tamid, the switch not only with finding Yehoshua, but with a switch in the way that we behave. So before this, the behavior towards Hashem, Hashem towards us was all gifts. Right? He did the miracles. He gave us the well. He sent us the man. He gave us the clouds of glory. He gave us. Now with this Korban Tamid, the daily offering, it's time for us to start putting in something to get something out. Right? It's time for our Hishtablus to begin. So it's not that, and as we know, we've probably seen in our own lives, our Hishtadlut, our efforts, don't necessarily equal the benefits from that.
What's that all about?
Right? It's important to know that it's not what we do that makes it happen. So we should never think that if I don't do this, it's not going to happen. It's never a quid pro quo. You can work on a shidduch, and it's not going to happen. And somebody else could see that girl and say, I think that girl and that guy will go great. But because you did all the phone calls and everything, you put in all the effort, so when that person mentions it to the mother, she's like, what a great idea that is. Right. It was not your effort that made the result. The result happened, but it couldn't happen without the process. So we're supposed to engage in process and never worry. I mean, of course, the way that nature works, we direct ourselves towards results. But we have to remember that we are above nature, and so the results are not in our hands. We're just supposed to do what we're supposed to do, and Hashem's in charge of results. So we have to keep that in mind always for every project, whether it's for earning money or producing a meal, or producing a child, or whatever it is, building a community, whatever it is, we put in our efforts in whatever direction, and Hashem's in charge of results. So if it doesn't work the way we thought either, okay, we could look at our efforts, but we could also know Hashem chose for that not to happen. And so it's not up to us. It doesn't mean that we broke down in it, because it's not that our efforts produced the result. It's that Hashem picks the results.
Or didn't produce the result.
Or didn't produce it. That's what I'm saying, right? It's not that our efforts produce it or didn't produce it. Hashem's in charge of that. And we could get very arrogant and think, all the work I did produced this.
Or the other way around.
Or vice versa.
Or
totally
I
depressed.
Did it.
Right.
Sits around all day. And
right. It's easy to judge others and say, oh, they didn't do, right? Which we should never do. Mm-hmm. But even our own selves we need to be careful. So we do have to look and say, are my efforts what they're supposed to be? But we can't necessarily read from results or lack thereof that our efforts were appropriate. Nevertheless, this is the transition in which our efforts make a difference. So it says in Pirkei Avos, just to remind everyone, lo alecha hamlecha ligmor v'lo ata ben charin lehibatel mimena. It's not your job to finish the work.
It's your job to begin.
But you're not free to desist from the process, right. Not free to desist from attempting. You have to keep going, whether or not you see finishing. Right.
And it may not have been yours to finish. The whole process you go through might have been more for you than it was for somebody else, for a growth factor within you or some other offshoot that you don't know about. Maybe you weren't meant to do the shidduch. However, all the things that
right.
you did in preparation made a change in you, whatever, a growth in you, whatever. So it's
right.
never wasted if the effort's in the right direction, is what I'm trying to say, with
right.
good intention.
Right. And you see, I mean, I forgot who told the story, but I think about a specific little tiny store that I go to occasionally in Israel when I think about this story. But one of these little kiosks, you know, that carries everything. So he carries all notebooky stuff and pens and pencils and umbrellas and whatever, little things. So one day somebody went and they needed a ballpoint pen, right? And he looked all over that store for a one shekel ballpoint pen till he could find the new box of ballpoint pens. It took him the whole store. It looked 20 minutes, you know, to go through. And finally found it and sold him for a shekel. 25 cents he made, right? Nothing. But then, so all that effort he did to serve a customer, but he went through his whole store. Now he knew where everything was.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody came in a rush, a wealthy person. He needed like a fancy Schaefer pen, you know, whatever it was. He knew exactly where it was. So he went to it exactly like that.
Yeah.
Because he had put in the effort for that. So you don't know the effort from one to the other.
Right.
Doesn't make the difference. One was a $10 sale. One was a 25 cent sale. One took a ton of effort. One took zero effort. Who knows, you know, what effort
you'll
is necessary.
It all balances out.
Right.
But it doesn't always.
It doesn't always balance out, but that's what we have to know. It's not,
right.
We can't necessarily read it. So we are supposed to look at our efforts and see, am I doing the right thing towards the end? And also we're supposed to separate the end from our efforts.
Yeah.
That's hard to do. It's one thing,
exercise.
You know, I think that keeping in mind your efforts toward an end, that's you know, doable. But then to say, well, but the end may or may not ever happen and it's totally out of my control if it does happen.
It's even harder than that. Because if the end does happen, if the end does happen, you have to say it wasn't me that did it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Both.
Right.
You can't take pride in it.
Right.
You can take pleasure in it.
Yeah.
But not pride. It's not, look what I did.
Yeah.
I arranged the most beautiful whatever. You can't. You could say, look how nice this is.
Turned out, right.
Look how nice this turned out. This is great. But to take pride in it means you really think you did it.
If you will immediately say, thank you, Hashem, for allowing me to be a part of this process.
If only we were so good.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But it's so important because it's so easy to get arrogant.
It's hard to do that, yeah.
It's so easy to think, you know, I'm the one that did it. You know, I can make this happen. I can make that result. You know, everything from weight loss to a beautiful singing voice to an organized event to whatever it is, you know.
Yep.
Different people have different skills and abilities. And who knows, you know. Everyone has to put in their part.
It's all very interesting on little 401.
Right.
Well, we haven't even started it yet.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Just scratch the surface.
Okay, so that's the beginning of that. Okay, so now. Okay, so here's the mitzvah 401. That the Israelites were commanded that they should offer up through the ministering servants of the eternal Lord, namely the Kohanim, two lambs in their first year without blemish as olah, burnt offerings every day. The first in the morning and the second toward the evening, as it is stated, command the Israelites and say to them, my offering, my food, etc., two a day, a continual burnt offering. However, the principal injunction is for the Beit Din, in other words, the scholars, instructors of the Torah in Israel, for the tasks of the community are imposed upon them, meaning that's their mitzvah, right? As the sages of blessed memory interpreted and say to them is injunction to the Beit Din.
Hmm. So not individuals.
Right. So the question is, I mean, that what difference does that make? Here's another vocabulary word for you that's important to know. Nafka mina. Does everybody know that word yet?
Nafka mina.
It's two words. Nafka mina. right? So nafka mina means what practical difference does it make? Mm-hmm. Right? So the practical difference, so tell me, what's the nafka mina in how would you interpret the words and say to them? What would be the nafka mina as to the them?
The priests.
Okay, that's the nafka mina, right? Okay, so if you say it's the priests, what's the other option? And say to them?
The people.
The people. Okay, so what's the nafka mina between priests and people?
It's for everybody.
Well, everybody as opposed to the people whose main job that is. So if it was your job as an everybody to do a sacrifice every day, you'd spend most of your time getting the sacrifices
right.
ready, preparing them, taking care, acquiring them, taking care of
it. So let's say we know that that's not it, but the question is, who will be transgressing if it's not done?
The whole community.
So let's say it's our mitzvah, each one of us, right? So it's a whole community mitzvah, and the Kohanim fall down on their job, right? So then each one of us does have to leave our work or whatever and make sure it gets done,
right?
Because it's our mitzvah and we're transgressing
if they don't do it.
But if it's the Beit Din's mitzvah,
then it's their
then it's not my job to leave my field to make sure it's offered, right? I'm out of it.
Right.
Mm. It's offered on my behalf, but the nafka mina is who has to make sure it gets done?
Those whose responsibility is.
Right, right. That's the nafka mina. Right, so in this case, it's the Beit Din. So that's what I'm saying. The nafka mina is how does it practically manifest.
Okay, so
right.
So just go to the back to the beginning. So that the Israelites were commanded they should offer up two lambs per family, per person.
No,
per nation.
Per community.
Per nation.
Per nation.
Yeah. Per nation.
Yeah. So two a day.
Yeah.
Right.
So two a day.
So two a day.
Yeah,
so that wouldn't feed the
Kohanim. No, it doesn't feed them. And these are burnt offerings. These are ceremonial.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't eat these. Right.
Are all olas ceremonial?
It would be so good if I could answer that question.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was trying to remember.
Well, but there were some things I thought where you burn
totally
partially. And
yeah, there are some that you burn partially.
Yeah. Where you burn partially and eat partially.
Well, so Korban Todah, you only burn part and you eat a lot.
So I would say they're all not burned completely.
Right.
Because
well, so the question is, an Ola.
An Ola. Okay.
She's saying that's a specific type
Ola.
Of offering.
Oh, okay.
Is an Ola always burnt completely? And I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I don't know if there's different Olas. Right, yeah. Really, totally. Yeah, I should get a chart. I have to make a chart of the korbanot. I'll try to do that this week. Make a chart of all the korbanot and what they, how they work. It would be good for me to do and us to see. But the when it says command the Israelites, saying to them, the them here is referring to the Beit Din, which means that they're the ones who are in charge of doing this. But it is for all of us. Regarding the religious duty of animal offerings, I wrote in the precept of the sanctuary, which we spent quite a bit of time on, the first positive precept in Sidra Truma 95. What comes to my mind about the plain meaning of the subject. So that he writes there, if you remember that mitzvah, about the honor of the sanctuary, that there is a thing of creating an environment and creating a ceremony and creating a, in order to create a feeling of connection, a feeling of elevation, a feeling of awe in all of us, why that needs to be created, and that doing things like this offering is about that. So clearly it's not about appeasing God. We're not feeding God. We're not giving God good smells. That's not what it is, and that's what's important to know here. That this is not like pagan offerings, which are to the God, to as a quid pro quo, right? So that's what's interesting here is we do say this is a difference in hanhaga, a difference in behavior from what we have done, where before we have been just receivers, and now we are told to engage in. Ritual, but it's not that we do this so that we can get that. It's not. It's that we are required to engage. We are people that have to participate somehow, whether or not the results bring anything. But we still have to be participating. As I've said many times, a man is influenced and his nature stirred according to the occupation of his activity. Therefore, since a man is so constrained that he needs to prepare food for himself twice a day, or six, twice a day, according to this. He was commanded to set his purpose and occupation about the business of the service of the Creator, likewise two times a day, so that the work of the servant for himself should not be greater than his service to the master. So really,
so
if you
shouldn't eat more than twice a day.
Well, so I think the idea, well, even...
Except on Shabbos, when we can have moussa.
Right, so, well, we have three times a day, but we really, two are big and one is little, right, depending on how we arrange our lives. But in general, whether we have breakfast for dinner, like they do in Israel, mm-hmm. Which they don't even do anymore, but they used to. Still, one meal is the faster meal, just bread and butter, or just a bowl of cereal, or just yogurt and granola, whatever it is, like that's a not-prepare meal. And then there's two prepared meals. So that's what this is saying, is you shouldn't be preparing more for yourself than you're preparing for Hashem. But the point is here, we're body and soul, so don't take care of our bodies more than we take care of our souls. Our souls need to eat too. So if we're feeding our bodies, we should be feeding our souls. Because really we're here for our souls to grow. So we have to make sure that we are participating in soul care as much as we participate in body care.
The body screams much louder than the soul.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's one reason why we have brachot before and after we eat. Right. And particularly why we have benching and why it's a good idea to wash if you're having a whole meal. It's not a good idea not to wash if you're having a whole meal. Because the whole point of benching is to balance out the physical that you just engaged in. You ate a lot. Bench a lot. Right? Don't get away with a boring nefeshot because you had meat and you had rice and you had salad and you had cooked vegetables. Right? You had a whole meal and you're stuffed. And now you're going to say boring nefeshot? Really? You know, wash. Have one bite of bread so you can have the whole benching to balance that out. You know, that you do need to balance the physical with the spiritual. So you need that as deeply as you engaged in the physical and the eating, as much as you ate, you need to balance that with the spiritual of benching afterwards. Let's see. Where did we get here? And why all this? In order to bestir his spirit and desire continually to remember his creator, and thus he will make his actions worthy and will be blessed by him. Oh, see, so here's two things. Will make his actions worthy, and then the blessing will come. So we do need to, we don't know what the results will be exactly, but we do have this formula of if we behave correctly, we open up channels for bracha. That we do need to act in order for bracha to come. So in order to make his actions worthy, and he will be blessed by him, for he delights in loving kindness. So that's an interesting thing to say here after our korban. Okay, where's the chesed in the korban? Not answering the question, just asking it. As our sages of blessed memory interpreted, an offering by fire, a pleasing savor to the Lord, it is the satisfaction of spirit for me that I spoke and my will was done. In other words, the entire divine supernal share of any offering is nothing more than his fulfilled desire. So Hashem doesn't care about the animal, the smell of the animal, how you offer it, except for he cares what you do to offer it. The whole offering that he wants is the offering of our will. That we follow directions. That's what he wants. Yep. Do what he said. That's the offering that he's asking for. That the servant did what he commanded him, that he might become virtuous to attain his good reward. Right? So it's not about, again, it's not about the thing. It's about doing what Hashem said. Which is why we could just see in this last week's parsha, Shmini, what sad thing happened in Shmini. The two sons of Aaron died. Why?
Fire.
Why? They were killed by fire. Uh-huh, but why?
Because they made sacrifices that weren't asked for. Right. They made up their own.
So it's a very tricky thing because, and I think we really have to be careful about that.
It's hard. It's like overdoing. It's like doing more than. Exactly. More than.
Yeah. Right. So we are asked sometimes to do more than. And we're asked to do the more than only within the construct of what's actually desired and not to make up our whole own Judaism.
It's sort of like going to extreme, going to excess. In other words, anything carried to an excess beyond what the...
There's carried to excess, which is a problem, and then there's making up our own stuff. So I think we get into that in some New Age Judaism and in some feminist Judaism. You know, let's say we would take a bunch of tambourines and say, we're like Miriam, we're going to take tambourines... And she shook tambourines, and she was careful to bring them because she anticipated redemption. So we want to be those that anticipate redemption. Let's take our tambourines and dance at the new moon. The new moon is anticipating redemption, right? You can't see anything. We're looking forward to it becoming bigger. Redemption is coming. We're going to be women of the moon and dance with our tambourines. That's a strange service. That's not Jewish. It sounds Jewish. Mm-hmm. And people do that. People do that.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Went to one once.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say,
summer,
I mean,
solstice.
Yes, yes. Stuff like that is done and made up,
so,
and it's not
pagan.
Jewish.
It seems pretty pagan.
Solstice
doesn't it?
Is very pagan.
But it's not. So the point is, there are things that could sound Jewish that aren't Jewish, and Hashem's not asking for that. And it's very harsh, but that's what we learned in Shemini. Cut it out with making up your own stuff, because I'm giving you stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But that's
listen,
what I'm saying.
If you do all the stuff you're supposed
exactly.
to, you're plenty busy.
You shouldn't
right.
need to add any little trinkets.
Right, but not only that, but Hashem gave a clear lesson. Don't go making up. This is not made up. And so you can't just go making up whatever you want and calling that service. Don't just go in the temple and do your little thing in addition to my thing.
Right.
It's not like they were doing it instead
add on.
Of.
No, it was an add-on.
Don't go adding
right.
on.
Right.
That's what he's saying. I gave you Torah and mitzvahs. I gave you the way to use the physical to grow your spiritual. Don't go adding on.
So now all of a sudden you know better than I know.
Right. So that's what he's saying, that the servant did what he commanded him, that he might become virtuous to attain his good rewards. That's what Hashem wants.
Here's kind of a question. It's very theoretical. Was it easier when it was so designated, so drawn out, so you do this, this, this?
Okay, excellent. So now let's...
Or now, today, when we go, well, you know, davening is an offering and...
Right, very difficult.
Was it easier just to say,
okay,
get you lamb?
In addition to the transition of Hashem just giving to us, over us having to participate... That's where the transition begins, which we mentioned last time, the transition between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah that was given to us, where we just receive it, and Torah that we have to work at ourselves to mine and unfurl and pull forth and figure out, which is what the Benot Slavchad did, right? We talked about that last time, how... In the laws of inheritance, right? In the laws of inheritance, Hashem said, this is how you inherit. And then the daughters of Slavchad said, wait a second.
No.
What about us?
Right.
You know, we have no brothers. Our father died. Who gets that property? I think we should. And so that was also a transition moment in people causing halacha to come into the world. Right? The Torah being given was Hashem saying, plunk, here's the Torah. But the Benot Slavchad, already in the Torah, turned up to Hashem and said, give us a piece of halacha that makes this work for us. Right, and that's what Torah Shebaal Peh is. We were given Torah Shebaal Peh. This is how it works, but it continues to unfurl. It's not a static thing. Torah Shebichtav is static. Written Torah is static. But Torah Shebaal Peh is not static, which is one important reason why it was told, don't write it down. Writing something makes it static, and we've gotten into big trouble for writing
yes,
it down.
Yes.
Big trouble, because once it's written down, you can't change it. So you write down, don't eat kitniot on Pesach, and now you're stuck. Right? Now everybody has to not eat kitniot on Pesach, because that's been written down, that's the law, that's what we do. And that is what we do. There's no question about it. We're not saying we're not doing that. However, if it wouldn't be written down, then we could say, in this time, it seems that we're really confusing grains, and you might find wheat in your rice, and so therefore, don't eat rice on Pesach, because you could easily find wheat in it. Or we regularly grind up, we use rice flour in our country, and since they regularly mix up grains, we don't know if there's a little bit of wheat in our rice flour. You can't separate it, you can't tell, and therefore, we're careful not to eat flours of different things. Okay, that's in that country. But if you go to another country where they don't have...
They don't mix it up.
They don't mix it up
with
it.
They don't have any wheat.
Or they never use that kind of
right.
flour or whatever it is. Like, then what, right? So then if... Then we could say, nope, it's not... Once you write it down, it's written.
Right. But didn't it have to be written down? Otherwise, it would have been forgotten.
Lost.
Okay, so the Torah Shebaal Peh did have to be... We transgressed to write it down.
Mm-hmm.
Hashem said,
oh,
do
yeah.
not write it down.
Mm-hmm.
And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said, I hear you, Hashem, but we're in such danger right now of losing it that it must be written down. This is a time to act on Hashem's behalf and write it down. Now, human beings are permitted to do that. We forget that today because we're so timid. And we are much further.
Do
we don't,
that mean going against Hashem's?
Well, sort of.
We're so timid in moving forward and what needs to be done. We're very...
You said we're allowed to do that.
We human beings, I'm not saying we in this room, we human beings, those who have the appropriate education, background, midos, everything, we human beings are permitted to say, this is what needs to be done, and to proclaim something. This is the basis upon which the conservative movement initially made rulings that were contrary to what the Orthodox believed, because they took it upon themselves and said, we are the committee who gets to make those decisions, and therefore driving is okay, right? And so they voted that in. They now regret that.
They only voted
to shul. Correct. Driving to and forth, driving to and from shul, right, is okay. But they voted that because there is the concept. It's true. It's just tricky how to apply it. There is a concept that the Torah does not exist in heaven anymore. It's completely been given into our hands. And now once it's been given to us like any gift, we get to do with it what we want. So we have to be careful with that. Like what, you know, how do we...
What does that mean exactly?
What does that mean exactly? It's a tricky thing. So people have misinterpreted.
And who is the we?
And who is the we? And how does that work?
False messiahs.
Exactly. So we only know truly in hindsight. I mean, that's how we can definitely tell, is hindsight. We can't always tell in the moment. Sometimes we really can tell in the moment.
You gotta get that kidney off guy.
Sometimes we can tell in the moment because we see things that are so deviant. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Had to be.
Right. Sometimes we
definitely
see in the moment
women
that...
women can't do it. Right. It doesn't matter.
Right. So, well, so women do make changes
in halacha. But thank you to whoever discovered quinoa wasn't.
Right. Right.
That helps.
So, so the point is sometimes we can see when people are clearly deviant. And it's obvious. Like... I mean, I guess there are people sometimes who follow them. Like you have the slave to horse sect, which is clearly deviant. Nobody thinks it's not deviant. I don't know if you've heard about this.
No.
It's a cult, a Jewish cult, a cult of people who are born Jewish, who think they're keeping the Torah, who are fanatic nuts, where the women are basically wearing burkas.
Oh, you were talking.
Where they're getting the girls are engaged. The Rebbe decides who marries who and who divorces who. The girls are engaged at 12 and a half, sometimes to men 20 years older than them. They have no say in the matter at all. Even if they object to their parents, the parents say, this is what the Rebbe said, you've got to do it. It seems that everybody's been drugged, whether it's melatonin or whatever. It doesn't seem like it's an illegal drug, but that the entire...
It's in Israel.
It's in... that's the Shaul cult is in Israel. This is even worse.
This is something else.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's in Canada. It was...
Oh, yes. There was a thing in the Jewish news about it. Yes. I read about it.
Crazy.
They tried to go get to take some children from the group.
And they
Because
fled.
They felt that they... Yeah, and they fled. Yeah,
I think they first went from Quebec to Montreal, and then they tried to get it to Argentina.
Right.
And anyway, it's a crazy, crazy cult. So right now, today, we don't even need hindsight to see that they're freaks and they're incorrect. And that's not Torah, and we all agree on that. Like, nobody's thinking that they're correct, except for that one drugged group. But nobody else thinks they're right. Look, we're very clear on that. And I think, you know, people, you know, the conservative group that judged that you could vote, you know, that you could decide you could drive, the rest of the Torah-keeping world was very clear on that, too. And so now, in hindsight, everybody sees that that was wrong, even conservative Jews. I mean, even those who are in enough know to know halacha and know how the process works realize that it worked wrong. But sometimes you can't tell until hindsight. You know, you have to look back. So reform is also looking back and saying, canceling all rituals wasn't a great idea.
A little too much.
Let's move forward and accept rituals, right? So,
Yes, Rabbi Foster wore a kippah on shul on Shabbos.
He did?
Yeah. He was there. He was at BMH.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. In BMH he wore. He didn't in...
No.
Right.
Well,
right.
But in a lot of Reform places, though, now. They
Rabbi,
generally wear...
But Rabbi Black does, and Rabbi Rhines does.
Rabbi Rhines
right, now it's
always,
okay.
Yeah.
But when Ephraim went into, 30 years ago, wearing a cap, he used to wear his yarmulke and a cap, you know, one of those Kangol caps that you used to try to disguise yourself in back in the day. Mm-hmm. So he was wearing one of those, and he went into whatever the big Reform shul is in Manhattan. I forgot what it's called. Temple Emanuel in Manhattan. So he went into Temple Emanuel in Manhattan, and the Shamish came over to him and said, "Sir, please remove your head covering. You are in a house of God."
Wait a minute.
How interesting.
Yeah. So that was Reform back in the day. And today, they're not going to tell you to take off your head covering. It'll be your option.
Au contraire.
Yeah, they want you to wear one today.
Yeah.
Yeah, feel Jewish. Put on a yarmulke. Yeah, so we can't always tell until we see the hindsight. Nevertheless...
The angels were probably correct in their conversation with Moshe in the Midrash. You're going to give it
right.
to these people?
Right.
Are you kidding?
Right. Okay, so they had their legitimate argument, and yeah. Hashem had his.
Yes, yes.
Hashem usually
wins. Yeah, Hashem gets to win.
Yeah.
So Hashem told Moshe to fight back. He said, and the Moshe right. said, I don't know how I get this, the Midrash. And when the angel said, what, you're going to give it to? Moshe stands there, and Hashem says, I have a present for you. Wait, I'll go get it. And the angels meanwhile say, Hashem, are you kidding? You're going to give it to people? What, are you nuts? They're going to ruin the whole thing.
Yeah.
And Hashem says to Moshe, defend yourself. And Moshe says, I can't. They're angels. Their breath is going to burn me up. If they just open their mouths to argue with me, I'll vaporize. And he says, it's a weird Midrash. It's grab onto my kisei hakavod, grab onto my throne of glory, so and connect into the force field that will protect you,
uh-huh.
right? Yeah.
And then you can answer them. So he answers them, and so his answer is, look at the document. It says honor parents. Right. Do you angels have parents? Right. How could you keep this? It says eat kosher food. Do you eat? Only human beings eat. Clearly this is for us and not for you. And he was able to take it down to earth.
Right,
right? So that was his answer. The answer is that it's meant to be engaged in.
Right.
Right? So, and
the arguments.
We're meant to sin through it too, to grow through that.
Well, otherwise, we wouldn't have any need to. Yeah.
Right. So, anyway, writing it down makes it a problem.
Is it a midrash that God said, don't write it down? Or is it
No, written? No, that's the halacha. That's the halacha. Do not write it down. I don't know where that halacha is. But the Hashem said clearly, do not write down the oral law. And we had to do it. And we paid the price. I'm not sure, but it's
only
clear.
The oral law, because obviously the written law.
The written law is supposed to be written. Yeah. And it's interesting, the written law you're not supposed to memorize. So there is even, I don't know if it's a hanhaga or a halacha, but we're definitely, you're supposed to, it's considered best. That if you're quoting a pasuk to read
you look it up.
You should not right. you should right. not say
go
it from memory.
Memory.
Yeah, you should read it out loud from the text.
Right.
It should not be memorized. It's written Torah and should be
most of the usual.
Well, but that you know, I mean that if you think about it, that's very logical because even things that you memorize sometimes you forget a word. Or I mean, even with your memory.
Right. So that there's different ideas also. There's look these mystical ideas. Something that's written, rashum, lichtov means to write, but so does lirshom mean to write. So lirshom means to write, but it also means to make an impression.
So lirshom.
So it makes more of an impression if it's written down. So you want to connect into the writing of it. Right. That's important. Mm-hmm.
That's important to
see it written.
A learner, right?
Yeah.
Me too.
So, but Torah Shebaal Peh is supposed to be Baal Peh. It's not supposed to be written down. It's a different type of learning. It's supposed to be heard. It's supposed to be spoken. It's a different way of getting it.
That he spoke this to his son, or he wrote it?
No, this is written down.
This was written.
This is written down. Right, so then the question is, what parts of Torah Shebaal Peh should be written, shouldn't be written, all that kind of stuff, right? So it's very tricky, but we definitely see a process by which we need to have more halacha written down. And by which we're weakened by having that halacha written down.
Sort of a double-edged sword.
It is definitely a double-edged sword, you know? I mean, just think about constitutional law. When the Constitution says, all men are created equal.
Right.
Okay.
What does that mean? You get three-fifths
what
of a
What does vote. That mean, right? What does that mean?
Women?
So, right, does it mean women? Does it mean foreigners? Does it mean people of color? Does it mean poor people? Does it mean landed people?
Does it mean children?
Yeah. Who is created equal? Right? What does that mean?
And that has been an evolving...
Right, so that's been evolving. But once you start to write things down, think about how difficult it is. Once you write down...
An amendment or...
Black people are not equal. Mm-hmm. It's written now.
You get three-fifths of it.
Then the interpretation... It's much harder to move
working
past
with another the concept.
Much harder to move past that concept once it's written.
Because you have to get rid of what's written.
We had to unwrite.
You have to get rid of what's written before you can change the
that's
interpretation.
Right.
Or
right,
sort of,
right,
you know, but.
Right. Yeah, you do. So that's what made it more difficult once it gets written down.
Right.
So if it would just be left in the all men are created equal, then you can still interpret.
Right.
Does men mean men and women? Is that for all mankind? Does that just mean men? Does
all
that mean white?
Times.
Does that mean black?
Do you have to be over this age.
Right.
To, you know,
right.
Whatever.
Right. So it's still open to interpretation once it gets written down. It's much harder to work with. Nevertheless, it is important to write it in order to transfer it, particularly without the mass media that we have today. So if you want to decide in Washington that all men are created equal means men and women, and you need to get that idea out to California, right? So
And you have to write it down.
You have to write it down to get it there. You do. So, or to get it to the next generation. So, so it's a tricky thing. Meanwhile, back to this. Let's see. So the one more thing that I want to bring out of this is that it's a daily offering. That's the main thing here. That we have a concept of a daily, regular, doesn't depend on anything, doesn't depend on if you're extra
weather.
Thankful, doesn't depend on if you did a sin, doesn't depend on if it's a holiday. This is the daily offering.
So a daily offering occurs
daily,
and then the holiday one or the Rosh Chodesh one is in addition to.
Mm-hmm. This is daily. So one of the things we learned from this with the preface that we had, that we are supposed to be engaging, and Hashem gives us, but we have to engage for gift to flow. We need to open up those channels by our action, is still today, without offerings in the Beit HaMikdash on our behalf, we have to do something daily. Daily engagement with Hashem. Whatever that is, but we have to pick it out. But there's got to be daily interaction. We're not about the once a week model. I saw in front of a church, it was a cute sign that said, 7 prayerless days makes 1 week, W-E-A-K. Mm-hmm. Right? But we're not into 7 days in a row of not doing something that's once a week. And then if you miss the seventh, you've become weak. Right? It's that it's daily. You have to do it every single day. So we definitely have a concept of learning on a daily basis. Mostly for men, but women can take that on too if they want to. But
at least in the morning prayer.
Right, so at least in the morning prayer or praying on a daily basis. We've got to do something daily. So it's not that, and we just have to decide what it is. As women who have different ways of holding in halacha, we could hold different ways in siddur prayer if we want to say that every day. If we don't want to say it every day, we have to pray every day. But it could just be in our own words. So would that count as the daily thing? You have to think about what is your daily thing that you do every day without compromise.
Well, I guess it only is if you say, this is
my
daily
thing.
Prayer.
Right, right.
You
instead
can't
of just,
just
your,
say,
right. Instead of just
ooh,
your talking to Hashem.
Not getting hit when I ran that light.
Right, so you might be Yotze Tefillah by saying that. I mean, you may have fulfilled your obligation of prayer by that, but you might not have fulfilled your obligation of doing something daily through that, because if that's not your daily thing. So there's not a halacha that says thou shalt do something on a daily basis, but we do learn from this a concept that we do need to make our service
welfare.
Daily
right.
For our best welfare and engagement with Hashem, we need to do something daily. So whether that's learning daily, whether that's a chesed daily, just that something, whether we give tzedakah daily, some people just put a coin in every morning, a daily something that we do, whether it's learning daily, but something that we're doing because we engage in this daily. Now, it's especially for those of us who keep a lot of mitzvahs all day long, so that's a daily thing, but still we want to have something that we keep think about as daily. Right, so even if we get busy, even with a million things, there's something daily. Like, I was impressed what you told me, that even in the midst of all your stuff, taking care of Mishloach Manot and the Malav Malka, but at least the Shemes HaLashon thing that you did every day, that's what you kept during that time. So that's, I think, I mean, you might like to read the Parsha, you might like to review it, you might like to listen to a Shiur, you might like to write somebody, you might like to be calling people, say that, good Shabbos, whatever it is. But all that falls by the wayside when you're in the middle of a big project. But something has to stay daily. Something. So that's important, to establish something daily that we do. What? One thing. Even if it's the same, Birkas HaTorah, but that's what you say every single day without fail. That's what you do. You know, so you just have to have something on a daily basis. That's important. Okay, now let's move on to Musaf offering of Shabbat. We'll put it together with the Musaf offering of Chodesh for a minute. So there is Machloket that you should know about between... It seems at this point that the Rambam and the Ramban are on the same side, with the Chinuch who's always on the side of the Rambam, but against some other Gaonim, which is earlier than Rishonim. Right? If you remember the... from the destruction of the temple, I'm not going to go before that, but from the destruction of the temple, the periods of time, the people that how we call them, first we have Tanaim, they wrote the Mishnah. Then we have Amoraim, they wrote the Gemara. Then we have Geonim, that's from basically the close of the Gemara until around 900-ish. And that's when basically the period of the Geonim basically ends, although there's a few sprinkled in here, but basically ends.
Like in the Vilna Gaon.
Hang on a second to that thought. So we have the period of the Gaon, which basically ends around 900. The Vilna Gaon is?
11?
17.
So he's way later.
Way later, yeah.
Yeah, so we have the period of the Gaon ending around 900. That's also around the end of the major influence of Babylonia. Uh-huh. Right? That's the Gaonim, or in Babylonia. After that starts the period of the Rishonim. So the Rishonim include the Sefer Chanukah, the Rashi, the Ramban. Those are all Rishonim. And that period ends around the time of the Shulchan Aruch, around 1400, 1415-ish. Is the in-between, and then we have the Achronim, the after ones, right, the Achronim, and right now we're in the period of the later Achronim, which really began probably around 1900, or maybe slightly before, but like, so people that would be later Achronim would be the Chavetz Chaim, Moshe Feinstein, you know, people like that are later Achronim. So the rule is you can't argue, somebody of a later period can't argue on somebody of an earlier period, because the earlier period people knew more, you could add to, but you can't argue on. It's not always kept as a rule, but that's the basic rule. The Vilna Gaon, the reason why he got that title is because he was considered to be so amazing that they took him out of being an Acharon
and put him back in time.
Skipped over Rishonim and went back into Gaonim.
And gave him that priority.
That's the title he got because he was so amazing. The Vilna Gaon.
Although he lived later.
He lived in the 1700s when he should have been an Acharon. Right.
But
he holds a very high level as a Vilna Gaon. Yes. Right, because they felt that's how brilliant he was. So cute to have those old-fashioned rings on these newfangled phones. okay, so we have... the Rishonim, who wrote this book and upon whose work this book was written, and we have seen arguments between the Rambam and the Ramban in other places in this book. They basically agree, however, that and are arguing with earlier sources, what is the mitzvah of Musaf? Earlier sources say it's one big mitzvah. All the Musafs, Musaf of Rosh Chodesh, Musaf of Shabbos, Musaf of each holiday, all is in one mitzvah of a Musaf offering. There's a mitzvah to offer a musaf at the right time. But that's not how the Rambam holds, or the Sefer Chanukah holds. They hold that each musaf category is a separate mitzvah. So Shabbos musaf is one mitzvah. Rosh Chodesh musaf is another mitzvah. Each holiday musaf is its own mitzvah.
So the count can change.
Yes. Mm-hmm. 613
always remains.
But
what's going on inside the 613 is a question.
Okay. So it's 402A, 402B.
It's not because they would have they'll add in other things and they'll take out other things in order to add this in. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So the counts are different. Okay, so just wanted to say that. So the precept of Musaf on Shabbos. So this is basically a short one, but we do have the concept, which basically works with creating that extra formality, but let's look at 299 where he quotes. Let's see. I did mark it up. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so because here it says, regarding the root reasons for the Musaf, additional offerings of the festivals.
It's two volumes.
Right. I wrote previously in Sedrat and more in the eighth precept, 299, the Musaf of Passover, what occurred to me. So in terms of the root reason of Musafs all together, so now for the purpose of root reason, he is putting Musafs together in one category. Mm. Okay? So whether it's a mitzvah or not, it's separate, but the root reason is one category. So for that, we're going to look at the Rambam, at the 299. Okay, the root of the precept lies a theme akin to what we have written above regarding offerings in 95. Which is about the honor of the importance of the Beit HaMikdash. Then a man is influenced according to his action. For since he is a material physical being, his thought does not cling to anything except through some action. For this root reason, God, blessed is he, commanded us to carry out a special act in honor of the day in order that we should be impressed by it. To reflect on the greatness of the day and its holiness along with the miracles and favors that God, blessed is he, rendered us at that time of the year. Or at that time. So Musaf is just to make the extra impression of the extra impression days, right? So we have extra impression days, that's Shabbos, that's Rosh Chodesh, and that is the festivals. And on those days, the extra impression days, we have an extra physical thing to engage in that will help make a deeper impression on us. So that's the root reason of Shabbos Musaf. It's just, it's a separate mitzvah. So when it says on the Sabbath day, bring two lambs, etc.
And there's just different animals. Like on Shavuot, it's...
Well, right.
Additional animals on...
So Shabbos, you get two additional lambs.
That's
right.
Why you have a Musaf.
Right, because you have a Musaf offering. Mm-hmm. The prayers parallel the offerings. Mm-hmm. So we have a Musaf prayer today in place of the Musaf offering of those days. There is a machloket, whether women are obligated in the Musaf prayer. Because the question if they're obligated in the Musaf offering. And it seems that they're not obligated in the Musaf offering. So there's a machloket on this. It's an interesting machloket. So it's so interesting listening to Rabbi Rosner, because he goes, you know, into such halachic things and all these different sources and all these different things. But just to hear this little piece, which I can't remember the whole thing of, but just to hear this. So he says women are not obligated in it. And how do we know? Because they don't bring the chetzi shekel.
Oh, they don't bring the half shekel for the...
They don't bring the half shekel for the
census.
For the census, which is what all public offerings come from, and therefore they're not obligated in this. So that's one perspective. Arguing on that is saying, oh, really? What about Kohanim? They also don't bring it. What about under 20s? They also don't bring it. What about over 60s? They also don't bring it. Are they not obligated?
They're not counted in the census.
They're not counted, but are they not obligated? So that position says, after asking that rhetorical question, in fact, they are, clearly we see they are obligated, so it must not, therefore, be contingent upon whether one gives the half shekel or not.
Yeah, that was my...
And therefore, women would be, right? You can't use that, and therefore women would be. Okay, so I'm just saying these are two arguments that are given. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how does that work? Are we part of the klal that the chetzi shekel is given on behalf of or not? And if we are we obligated? Are we not? Is it dependent on that or not? Should we daven it or not? May we daven it? We may. Are we obligated? We are not. But is it a good idea? It is. That's the end.
But are we obligated for chakras?
So they're getting tricky. Right.
It's time bound.
Yeah, time bound. Yes. You say it at a particular time, but you can't say it.
You can say it, but are we obligated?
You can.
Some people say you're obligated, and some people say you're not. Are you obligated to daven on a daily basis? Yes. Every single Jew is obligated to daven on a daily basis. Actually, even that's a machloket. Because it seems, I think, and I wish I remembered exactly who, I'm pretty sure the Rambam says the actual d'oraisa obligation of tefillah is only when you're in stress. That you have a d'oraisa obligation to daven in times of duress. So if somebody's having surgery, if you're worried about a car accident, if it's a time of war, whatever, you're worried, you have to daven then and say, Hashem, please help me out. You have to at that time. That's d'oraisa. So everybody agrees on that. Now the question is there a daily obligation? And if there's a daily obligation, which most people agree there is a daily obligation of praise, request, and thanks, that everybody has to engage in praise, request, and thanks, that equals tefillah. So then the question is, do you have to use a sitter for that? So most people, I mean, pretty much across the board, halacha lamaaseh, practical halacha is women are obligated in praise, request, and thanks at some point in some way during the day. Benching counts, Birkas Torah counts, Shemona Esrei counts. And then there are those who would say a woman is obligated in Shemona Esrei on a daily basis, but it's time-bound. So she's not obligated to say it on time for Shacharis, but she has to say it every day. So there's different things with that. And then people would say, well, what's the community that you're part of? Because some people really feel that women are obligated in Shacharis and Mincha every day, and they will attempt to say it on time on a regular basis every day. Yes. Is that voluntary? Is that halacha?
Well, and then what about the old thing, if you undertake a voluntary, non-obligatory...
Correct. If you take it upon yourself, then are you obligated in it. Right. Then are you obligated
in yourself.
Right. Have you obligated yourself. Right.
Well, the schools are raising the girls with that as an obligation. Mm-hmm. So it will become, even as the older generation dies out, it will be even more so
It seems that
yes,
it is.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens with that.
Yes.
You know, we'll see how that goes. That's one of those hindsight only things.
Right.
You don't know. Right.
That's one of the things where you can't tell.
I'm seeing, though, all the young girls.
You can see it.
But
you can see it evolve.
The good friends that I have that are, you know, maybe 20 years younger than I am or 10 years younger, they were raised with that. So that's what they do also.
So we'll just see. That's what I'm saying. We'll see in 100 years
where we
if
go.
It's become an obligation.
Someone will see. We may or may not.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get to see. Yeah.
And there's one of the schools in New York is allowing girls to fill in.
Two schools
now.
Yeah.
Ramaz and...
And SAR.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
SAR, yeah. So we'll see what happens at that also.
Not demanding, but...
Right, not demanding. Just allowing. But even allowing is a big question. We'll see what that is. Mm-hmm. See how that goes.
How does the Torah treat that? I can't remember. How is that worded if you went with derisa?
It's not worded anything about it.
Okay, that's the logic that allows.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought though that Hashem said to that you should place it.
It's the Shema is where it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say.
Doesn't say anything about male
men.
Or female.
Doesn't say only doesn't men say, have to
yeah,
do that.
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
How is it stated? What are the genders? What are the words?
Doesn't matter.
It's just a.
Doesn't matter. It's a mitzvah aseh shehazman grama.
Okay.
It's a positive time bound commandment from which women are exempt. So most mitzvot aseh shehazman grama, positive time bound commandments from which women are exempt. Most of them women may participate in, like for instance saying the Shema, right? That's a mitzvah aseh shehazman grama, a positive time bound commandment,
but they can say it some other time.
Yeah.
Shema,
well, there's two things that you get out of saying Shema. One would be saying a verse from the Torah, which would be called the mitzvah of learning Torah, and one would be the mitzvah of saying Shema, which must be done before a certain hour. A woman can say Shema any time of day, but if she doesn't say it before that time cutoff, she has not said she has not done the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. Does she get an Aveira for missing it? She doesn't.
No.
A man does.
Don't need any more Aveiras.
Right.
Got plenty.
Right. So a man gets the Aveira for not saying it on time, a woman does not. And a woman does get the mitzvah for saying it on time. Okay, so that's Shema, that's Lulav, that's sitting in a sukkah, that's counting the Omer. Now the question is Tefillin. So Tefillin is different, and there are different halachic things that have gone on. So many people say Tefillin is the same. You could do it if you want. You're not obligated to do it. You could do it whenever you want. Just like a woman who shakes the lulav on the first day of Sukkot and the fourth day of Sukkot doesn't get an Aveira for not doing it on second and third and doesn't obligate herself for fifth. Right? She shook it twice on those days of Sukkot. Fine. Whatever. Right? So she could lay tefillin or not lay tefillin. Fine. Whatever. And then there are those who say this is a particularly male thing and a woman should not engage in this. Are we getting close enough that you're closing your books? This is crazy.
I have to be somewhere.
Okay, you could be somewhere.
Rarely do I do this.
You might want to listen to an interesting talk given by, I think, the principal of SAR, which is found online. I'll try to look for
the
link about the logic of it. And he specifically gave it not on Shabbos, so that it could be recorded, because he felt that the entire thing needed to be recorded to help with the discussion, because there's quite a bit of discussion, including a lot of bitterness over the issue, with a lot of people calling a lot of names. And it turns out that there is a lot of flinging around of names, whether you're liberal, calling the not-so-liberal Orthodox people, you know, ridiculously misogynistic, encaged, interpreters of halacha in self-serving ways, flinging around a name like that, or the right-wing people calling the left-wing people who are allowing it names like abandoners of tradition and tearers down of walls and destroyers of everything we hold dear, right? So
got it covered on both sides.
Yeah. So those kinds of names are being flung around in both directions. And so this person wanted to carefully go through the sources and say, we don't need to be calling names. There are different ways to look at it. Let's look at some of them from the sources. And I want to record this so that nobody can misquote me or misunderstand the tone of my voice. You know, nobody right. could quote it in a different way. You could listen to it, and you could listen to it again, and you could hear the way that I'm saying this. And he felt it was very important for that to be recorded. So it is available to listen to.
The principle of
SAR. I think it's the principle of SAR.
What is SAR?
It's an Orthodox school in New York.
What does that stand for?
I'm trying to remember.
Something.
Yeah.
Why would women want to take on these obligations?
Right.
Oh, so that's actually one of the questions.
I can sort of understand why some women might want to take on obligations that they are not obligated to do. I mean, by drawing lines and saying you can do this and you can't do this, some people feel that they're less.
Less.
I mean, I'm not saying everybody feels that way, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but they feel less.
Who choose to take that position.
And it's like anything else. Why would we choose to take on...
That we're doing today.
A mitzvah or a rite or whatever to do something that we don't have to do. There's all kinds of things.
So why is this different?
No, but the difference, I will tell you from my personal perspective, as somebody who never had a family, never had kids, you know, the woman's real important role is to raise children and instill on those children. And so I feel like if I can do it in a more public way with other people's children or as an example or with my... I mean, for me, that's because... You know, the synagogue would offer me the replacement, sort of a place to do that.
I hear that. I mean, with the home being the primary institution.
Because
I wouldn't say necessarily that raising children is the main thing, although a bit of emphasis goes on that. But it is the home.
The home, right.
Home itself.
Right, the home itself as a central institution of Judaism. So, and from that, all rituals flow and all life flows. So for the woman who doesn't have children, or particularly for who isn't married, or hasn't been married for long, whatever it is, so that I could definitely see how a woman in that position would feel very much like they don't have much to do or to accomplish in Judaism, and they want more. They want more.
Women do feel deprived in the synagogue.
Because they are
on the other side.
I think some people do, and in some environments, they are not paid very much attention to.
Oh, very much so, right.
You know, and so I can say.
You know, not being able to see the Torah read makes me...
Yeah.
No, I definitely hear that.
I would feel totally differently if I were sitting in the main sanctuary and I could see everything you see in the Torah.
You could feel more connected, connected, and that your soul and spirit and everything count in the whole community thing.
Definitely, I think particularly that where we've given the
experience in any of that,
where the synagogue has been given more importance.
If you stand in the main sanctuary of ZA.
Oh, I can.
And then you go to the Mechitza side. Mm-hmm. I think you.
I can tell you that one of the most singly emotional experiences in my life.
Too. I don't have a problem with it, but I think
there is a sense of disconnect.
One of the singly most emotional experiences in my life was holding a Torah scroll.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, it was a huge, we did it at a Rosh Chodesh thing at BMH several years ago. And I mean, I can tell you,
I cannot describe it. That part. When I went to, it was a Chabad thing, I think, many years ago, when I was the only woman, there was Mechitza, I was the only woman, but when they brought the Torah scroll out, or when they were putting it back, I guess, they brought it to my side for me to kiss it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was
very special.
That That's the only place that I've ever seen that done.
Sure I mentioned once.
But, you know, that was, I will agree, that was special for me to be able. So I pull the curtain back and I do this.
Right.
Now, at my sister's shul, the bima is exactly in the middle. I mean, it is...
Like a Shira Chadashah in Jerusalem.
Well, except that you can even, you know, it's even... And everybody sits around here.
You know, there's a shul, that's how it is.
that's, you know, I mean, the women are on this side, but the women get the exact same view that the men do.
Yes.
It's raised, it's, the women
see,
get to see.
See, that was the good part of that. The old shows in Europe, even
you could at least look down.
Yeah.
That's right, they had a balcony, so you could look down.
You could at least look down.
Yeah, I like the balcony,
At least you could see.
Yeah, you could see everything.
You're still separated, but you could see.
You're separated, but you're still part of the whole.
Although some of those screens are pretty.
Well, most balconies back in the day did not have screens. No, they were balconies. You could see everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. Right.
They had a railing to protect you, but they didn't have a screen also.
Darkhe Noam also is, you can see everything from the women's side and the men's side. It's sides, and the beam is
Portuguese, Spanish, Portuguese.
Yes,
Amsterdam.
Yes.
It has, it's a huge show. That's not even a show anymore.
It's a museum.
But it has two sides of balconies. You can see everything. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Part of the whole
and there's some show in Italy that I was in.
Cincinnati, actually.
That has one like that, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That the sides are women.
Right.
And we're
wasn't even in the back.
And they're kind of raised up.
Yeah,
the one that I went to kind of raised up, and the men are down kind of in a well. But it's only raised up like maybe three steps.
Like several steps.
Change is definitely coming.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely right.
You look at Darkhe Noam and Shirah Hadasha and Partner Minions, where it takes 10 women and 10 men to make a minion now.
I think that's interesting, and that's a different conversation. Do we need to obligate ourselves on that? Really? We have to wait for 20 people now?
It's a huge
And then it really gets hard.
It is a huge obligation.
Oh my God.
Sorry, to be continued.